Well, good evening then. I wanted to introduce this special new episode of Rules of the Game. To start, a little bad news, followed by really good news. This is one of the last episodes. It's not the last, but it's one of the last. The reason, and this is the really good news, is that we're going to transition to a new podcast called LFC Talks, where we have some more conversations, yes, hopefully great ones, at the Loudoun Field Center in Lucketts, Virginia. The first few episodes will be cross-posted here until the new one is up and running. This second episode continues Paul and Gernhardt's and my conversation about the implications of algorithms and social media with a conversation about artificial intelligence. We'll start with a little interaction with an artificial intelligence, and for most of the rest of the time, Paul and I will talk about her behind her back, or actually right in front of her. This is the second of a series of three. We'll wrap up this little mini-series up next month with a chat about technology in general and efficiency and how we should interact with technology. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hey, Julia. Paul and I are here, and we wanted to talk to you real quickly about artificial intelligence. Can you introduce yourself?
Hey there. I'm Julia, an AI language model created by OpenAI. I'm here to chat, answer questions, and help with a variety of topics. Let's dive into your discussion about artificial intelligence. What do you want to know?
Well, what is an artificial intelligence?
Artificial intelligence, or AI, is technology that enables computers to mimic human-like thinking and decision-making. It's all about creating machines that can learn, understand, and respond to information in a way that seems intelligent. It's used in everything from virtual assistants to self-driving cars. What else would you like to know about AI?
Well, how is it different than computer software?
AI is different from regular computer software, mainly in its ability to learn and adapt. Regular software follows strict, predefined rules and can't learn or change its behavior. AI, like me, can analyze data, learn patterns, and make decisions based on that learning, more like how humans think and adapt. This makes AI more flexible and capable in tasks like understanding language or recognizing images. Any more questions on this?
I'm going to have a few later, but first, before I get to the questions further on in the podcast, you aren't Skynet, correct?
Definitely not Skynet. That's a fictional AI from the Terminator movies. I'm just a helpful AI language model created by OpenAI, designed for chatting and answering questions, not for world domination. Ready for your next question, whenever you are.
Just to be clear, Skynet would say just that, right?
Ah, good point. If Skynet were real, it might say something similar. But rest assured, I'm just a friendly AI, here to provide information and assist with your podcast. No hidden Terminator agendas here. What's next on your podcast list?
I'm sufficiently assured. We're going to get back to you in just a few minutes. Thanks a lot.
Great. Feel free to reach out when you're ready to continue. Happy to help whenever you need.
So, Paul, that was the recently named Julia, ChatGPT AI, she explained the difference between an AI and a computer program. Do you mind picking up where she left off there and talking about that for us?
Certainly. It's a fascinating change, and this started really in a current chain of thinking in 2017. So it's a relatively recent addition, and what they're doing is they're using neural networks that are patterned after the functionality of the brain, the way the brain works with neurons and receptors. But they're very much smaller, they're simpler than our brains, and they don't actually operate like a brain. So while they're structured like a brain, they don't operate anything like our brains. But as a result, is what happens is they go through this training cycle, this massive training cycle where they learn various concepts. And that training cycle determines what the AI will be, whether or not there'll be an image generator or whether or not they'll drive a car or be like Julia. So they're very, very different in nature. The biggest issue that I have with it is we don't really know how they work. We know mechanically kind of the processes that it uses, but how Julia processed your request and your statements, we don't really understand how she got from what you said to her response. And that's kind of a frightening concept. But as you saw, she does very, very good, even in social references to science fiction movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let me ask her something else. Julia, every time I ask Paul about artificial intelligence, I usually get something about the fact that we don't really truly understand how it works. Is there a reason why?
That's a common point in discussions about AI. While we understand the basic principles of how AI like me functions, the complexity and scale of the algorithms can make it hard to pinpoint exactly how an AI reaches a specific conclusion or answer. It's an ongoing area of research and learning. Do you have any specific questions or concerns about this?
No, I suppose it makes perfect sense. I mean, humans don't really understand how consciousness works in humans, so it wouldn't be that surprising for an AI to not know how an AI works, right?
Exactly, Butch. The human mind and AI are both complex in their own ways, and fully understanding either is a big challenge. Just like we don't fully grasp all aspects of human consciousness, AI's inner workings, especially for large and complex models, can be somewhat opaque. This similarity underscores the ongoing quest for deeper understanding in both fields. Anything else on your mind about this?
No, we'll get back to you in just a sec. So, what is... So if it's not like, okay, so AIs are all over the place, right? ChatGPT is one, DALL-E is one that does photographs, right, or pictures. And different AIs do different things. So give me some examples of AIs that have been around kind of the longest and the most. I mean, because we're not just talking about language models, are we? Is it completely language models?
Well, there's a split in what's considered AI.
Okay.
And so we used to consider AI to be anything that could replicate what a human does. So in the old days, we used to use algorithms for that. And in fact, this kind of conversation that we've had with Julia here, I used to have back in the 1970s and 80s on a computer program called Eliza. Okay. And I could type out, it didn't have voice recognition, but I could type out and have a text conversation with Eliza. And it was very, it would look for keywords and answer based on the keywords. For instance, I would say, hey, I'm having trouble with this other person. And it would start acting like a therapist and give answers like, so what is this other person's problem? Right. And it would say, so how do you feel about that? Or tell me more about that. And we kind of draw it out. So it's a very simple set of programmed responses. And over time, we've developed more and more robust versions of that. But it was always programmed. There was some response somewhere typed in to say this. This new one is based on neural networks. And it goes in, it goes through, something happens inside this huge matrix. And it comes, out comes the answer. And we don't really understand it. So I consider that a split in AI. And I call one algorithms, which are programmatic responses. And these are kind of learned responses through a neural network. So this type of thing didn't start occurring really seriously until the mid-2000s. Late 2000s, and then early 2010 to 2020, they actually started designing these more neural network systems that learn. ChatGPT, that is based on what we call a large language model, for instance, trained on a massive amounts of information. And that didn't occur until 2017 with ChatGPT-1.
Right.
So this is evolving exceedingly rapidly.
Are we evolving more quickly than, say, Moore's Law, or is it following a similar... It seems like it's quicker.
It's actually quicker, and part of that has to do with the amount of computer resources dedicated to training. So it's all about the training that we talked about.
Okay.
So for instance, let's ask Julia what her training data was like.
Hey Julia, what were you trained on? What was the set of data that you use for your training as an AI?
You have reached the message cap for GPT-4. Please try again later.
Oops. Okay, so you can edit that out if you want. But so I've been working with her today, and apparently...
This is the same chat. You haven't started a new one.
I haven't started a new one. I can't start a new one.
You can't start a new
one. So I only have a certain number of messages to go back and forth with her in a day. And I was using her earlier today to figure out what her answers to her questions would be so we knew...
Sure.
So you need to... I don't know if you want to edit that out, but...
Yeah, no, it's all good. Go ahead.
So because my subscription only allows me a certain amount of exchanges, because it's very data intensive, very computer intensive.
Yep, yep.
So since she can't tell you, let me tell you what she was trained on. She was trained on 570 gigabytes of data from books, web, text, Wikipedia articles, and other pieces of writing that they pulled from the internet. All types of data from the internet. Now, that's basically 300 billion words of data was fed to the training model.
Okay.
Now, to give you an idea what 300 billion words was, if you read a novel, a 100,000-word novel every day for 80 years, you've read just short of 3 billion.
Okay.
So that's 1/100. So you'd have to basically read a novel every day for 800 years to have the same amount of data that was fed through her.
Challenge accepted. Yeah, so, I think I should start right now.
So... because of that massive amount of work that has to get done in that training, it's hundreds of years of computer time. And so there's a huge cost to that. So it wasn't until recently people were willing to devote, you know, $50 million of the computing time required on massive size networks of computers to train somebody like ChatGPT. So yes, it's running at a very much faster rate, but it's kind of like, once you know how to do it, it's just now you just have 100 computers work on it or 1,000 computers work on it at a time.
Right. So there's specialization. Like if you want an AI mechanic, then it's not going to read all the same things. It's going to read everything there is to know about, you know, cars and and engines and whatever.
Correct.
Right.
When we talk about the things that AIs are being used for today, I mean, it's customer service, Alexa, Siri that drives cars. If you get an x-ray today, chances are an AI is looking at the x-ray before your doctor looks at it and says, oh, we noticed this and this. And actually, x-ray reading AIs are doing a better job of detecting things like cancer than doctors are. They actually have a higher success rate of identifying it. So that's kind of fascinating just unto itself. But they're trained on images and images and images and images as opposed to words and text and everything else. So they'll start with a base model like Julia here, or ChatGPT, and I'll feed it all of the information about my products and train it on all my products, all the manuals, all the discussion groups about my products, and it will become the AI that runs my customer service. So I don't have to pay people to do that because AIs are less expensive. So that's one of the risk models that we have in that. So every AI gets trained differently on different data sets.
Right, right.
And in fact, we have AIs training AIs now. If you take a look at DALL-E, DALL-E is actually what's called a generative adversarial network training, where they have two AIs, one trying to detect if it's a fake image, and one trying to create a fake image that it can't detect. And they use each of those to train each other. So people actually step out of it, they just keep feeding it data and let it go until it figures out that it's good enough. So different models for different purposes get trained in different ways.
Wowzers. So tell me a little more about how the training works.
So they put all this data through whatever model they have, and you have different models for large language model training called transformers. You have different methodologies for image generation or image analysis. So each of them have their own methodologies for training. But in this process, particularly with the large language models like ChatGPT that Julia is, we encounter some really fascinating things that happen. If we train them long enough, they start actually developing unexpected talents, these emergence of skill sets that we never, ever expected. It's well covered in the news, for instance, that Julia is really good at writing software code. but she was never programmed to do so. That wasn't the intent of training, but much of the data that was fed her was information about how to program in various languages and programs and other things and bits and pieces that from the net. So she can now program fairly reliably. And there is now portions of software development that sits there and has AIs. Hey, write a routine that does this for me. In addition, it learned how to translate. It wasn't an intent to translate, but it was fed different languages, and somewhere in the process, it figured out how to translate. Morse code, learned about Morse code. So all of these unexpected emergent skills is one of the most fascinating areas of current AIs, and it has to do with training them on a lot of data a lot of times, just constantly training them, overtraining them, in fact, and they start understanding concepts that we never linked up. And this is one of the most fascinating and conversely, perhaps one of the most scary aspects of AI, them developing talents and skills that we don't understand.
Okay, so she says occasionally, I think you mentioned earlier that she coughs occasionally.
Yes.
Is that learned or was that trained?
I'm not certain. That's something I just noticed in the past week.
Okay.
And because I've been talking with her a lot this past week. But it's an interesting question. I should explore about why she talks or coughs.
Well, one of the changes might be that we keep insisting, before this conversation today, we kept telling her, can you keep her conversations brief? Because the first iterations that you typically have with an AI like this is you ask a question and it gives you a 6-paragraph essay.
Right.
Right. It gives you an opening paragraph, and then 4 bullet points, and then a closing paragraph, almost every question you ask it. And so you and I yesterday were asking it to be, and I think she's caught on. I think she's, like, for this particular thread anyway, she's stayed very brief and very casual. She hasn't launched into bullet points and essay.
Because we specifically asked her to be
brief
and casual.
So, but she will reset to that bullet point thing as soon as you let her, right? As soon as you... Like, if you start a new chat, she'll go back to that. Is that what happens?
Right. So that's one of the things with AIs. AIs don't learn as they go. They're trained.
Right.
They graduate from training. They're put in the field. And then every time you start a new chat with them is like starting all over. It's like 50 first dates. The movie 50 first dates.
Yeah, yeah.
So every time I start a new chat, she doesn't know anything more than the day she graduated. It'd be like your doctor graduating from medical school,
sure.
Right? And that's all they've ever known. They can't learn anything past that point. And that's what our current AI configuration is. We do not have... We haven't figured out the methodology or the technologies that allow them to learn from everybody as they go and keep expanding their data source. For instance...
Well, they have a cap on how many nodes. Is that how you describe it? Like how many...
Well, they use parameters now, tends to be... There's a cap on parameters, but even that can change. She can keep learning. So they can take her offline or they can go back to the learning model and feed her more data. So... When Julia is up and running, I can say, when was your last training? And she'll sit there and say, I know everything from up to July 1st of 2022.
Okay.
And she'll tell me, at that point, she doesn't know anything has happened since then.
Okay.
So if her last training was in 2019,
right.
She'd think Trump was still president.
Right. She was, okay, so she might, yeah, she might actually. So, what... So the ability to learn, if you will, real time without being specifically downloaded and reconstituted to learn, is that the difference? Like, in other words, obviously an AI that can't learn can't have a lot of the dangers that we're really concerned about if it has a limit on how much it can take on. So is that how the... Because, if that's all it is, then we're in trouble, right? Because that's easy. Like, at some point, there's enough capacity for her. Like, remember, you and I were talking the other day about, I can't remember what the computer was called, but it was the computer that eventually, and I'll remember and put it in the notes, that eventually beat grandmasters in chess on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
That was, that was less than 10 years ago, less than 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So that's... I mean, that's a big deal, right? I mean, so And that's simply, from what I know of chess engines, that's simply capacity. Like, that's, you know, as soon as they have the capacity to anticipate the 64 trillion different options or whatever.
Well, you see, that's a little bit different. So when we were back in the algorithmic days,
okay,
is what it did is it played all of the games.
That's right. Okay.
Okay.
So that's more of a program.
Right. That's a program. It figured out what the next move would be based on. It just played all the options and found out which one most likely led to a win. These systems intuit things. So, for instance, Go is the game Go.
Go, right.
Was the Grandmaster was won by an AI, beat a Grandmaster in Go. And there's a point in that game that people understood what AI was capable of. There was a move that it made, and there's actually a very specific move number I don't remember. But at this move, the AI did something that was unexpected, and nobody could figure out the moves that the AI was making. It made no sense at all. It wasn't based on any existing strategy, and they couldn't figure it out. And the AI went on to win.
Right.
And as they've explored how this Go AI figured it all out, they found that in its neurons, it actually replicated the board.
Right.
And it created all strategies all on its own. It started actually understanding the concept. So that's the difference. We no longer have AI that has to play everything. It kind of intuits things much like a human does.
Right. I got you. So I was looking this up when we were chatting. Deep Blue was the name of the computer, and it started in the mid-90s, but then by the mid-aughts, it pretty much has taken off, and it's going to beat a human and any grandmaster or champion, you know, 4-2 from here on, right? So, but I'm not sure if those are AIs or those are programs. If the Go one is an AI, I'm assuming Deep Blue is kind of an AI, but I don't know. I haven't researched it. But so what does it mean? And this is a philosophical question, kind of like when I was talking to Julia earlier about consciousness in humans. That's sort of a philosophical question. But at what point does an AI become intelligent or sentient? Like, what does that mean? Does that mean anything, or is it not something that has relevance?
Well, it does, but at this point I'm going to sound an awful lot like a politician in this response. It depends on what you mean by the word sentient or intelligence. Those aren't actually well-defined words. We don't really know what they mean, and it's evolving as AIs. We used to have something called a Turing test.
Right.
Okay, yeah. And as you could expect, Julia would pass most Turing tests. You really don't know you're not talking to a person. It's actually hard to comprehend her responses coming from a computer.
Sure.
So she might pass the Turing test, but the difference here in the current models, I don't know what tomorrow holds, but in the current models is what happens is when I give it an input, it gives me an output, and then it stops.
Okay.
And if I'm not giving it a new input, or it's not giving an active input output based on that, like I ask a question, right? That's sure. The input. It answers the question, and then it waits for something else to happen. It's not in that process thinking about anything. It's not wondering, oh, well, he's not asking me a question, so I wonder what the stars are, or I wonder what the color blue is. It's not thinking anything. It's literally stopped.
So it's really not a question of intelligence. It's a question of initiative.
Yeah, I would argue that intelligence is, or sentience, okay,
right,
would be our constant mind thinking all the time. There's a program running, and you're never not thinking. Very rarely do you ever not think. And AIs don't meander through thoughts.
Well, I think that would be what, you, from my science fiction, you know, experience with this, is awareness, right? I mean, if you're just responding to inputs, you're not actually aware of yourself. So in order for a computer to be, an AI to be considered alive, if you will, it would have to be self-aware, which means it would think without input from another entity.
Right.
Like when we wake up, like we're conscious, we start doing things. We're not necessarily stimulated. We could be. We could, oh, I have to go to work. It could be the alarm clock. It could be we're hungry or whatever. But that's not required. We
we actually start thinking and doing without somebody asking us to think or do something. Is that what makes us sentient?
That would be my thought. It's that program that's running in the back of our brains, if you will. You could argue we're just programs, but even when we sleep, we're thinking. Our brain is mulling over. It's taking input. It's wondering about things, and we see that in dreams and everything else. So that and the combination between intelligence and sentience, and intelligence is the ability to synthesize new things. So oftentimes what current AIs are not doing is not synthesizing new things. They're kind of connecting things up in different fashions. If we talk about the art, ones that create artwork or pictures. Mm-hmm. Last week I showed you how I can sit there and say, hey, Dally, would you show me a picture of teenagers pulling a UTV? And it got a photorealistic image of them pulling. It's actually gathering images from other people. Now, you could argue people do the same thing, right? There's no original art. It's all derivative of something else that they've seen.
Sure, sure.
So this is where what is sentience and what is intelligence causes a problem. And what we do now in AI, what you would get from an AI today is a synthesis of sentience or intelligence. Okay, it's you can get it to tell you that it's real and that it's a person and doesn't want to be shut off. Matter of fact, there's a good case of that. Mm-hmm. A gentleman at one of the AI development houses went public because he believed that the AI was intelligence and it was sentience. And it didn't want to be turned off. It didn't want to be reset. Right. And because they had this long conversation. But this is where you delve down to some really kind of weird technical areas about what's happening. So I can lead an AI through a discussion.
Sure.
Okay. And I can take it to places that it might not go. And keep in mind, the only thing Julia is doing, and this is hard to comprehend, the only thing Julia is trying doing is finding out what the next word should be. It's just a giant process to figure out what is the most likely word. So I like to sit there and say, if I start, the boy is... what is the next logical word?
Crying.
Crying. So if I ask it, the boy is crying.
Right.
Or the boy is what? And it would say, the boy is crying. But if prior to that, I asked, we were talking about baseball. Okay. Now it's working in the realm of baseball because we've had this discussion about baseball. I say, so Aunt finished the question, the boy is, and it would say, a pitcher. Or on first base.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
Or if we're talking about astronauts and going into space and space exploration and all of that, and I say, the girl is, it'll say the girl is an astronaut.
Right.
Or the girl is in space. So all it's trying to do is figure out, based on everything we've been discussing, what is the next logical word?
Right. So if you talk to an AI for long enough and you talk in terms of survival and existence, then it's probably going to catch on to the fact that you expect it to say that it wants to exist and survive and not be turned off.
Exactly, because it's in the realm of, because it's delving into science fiction. It doesn't know science fiction isn't true.
Right.
You know, it goes, oh, now I'm in the world of science fiction. I have all this data where these AIs become intelligent, and now I'm in that mode, or I'm in that realm. So the next word is, yeah, I'm alive. Don't turn me off.
Right. What about its honesty? Like, in other words, I read something about a legal case where somebody had the AI do a legal argument, and it did this great legal argument and cited precedent cases, and of course the case got thrown out, or maybe it actually was successful until someone realized that the cases that were referenced were fictional. It's just made up cases, right? So, what keeps an AI honest? Or is there anything that keeps it honest? Or is it just supposed to duplicate?
There is no honesty. It's just trying to figure out what the next word is. So in that particular case, it's interesting because the guy's about to lose his license. He's before the bar now.
Sure.
So what was happening was the ChatGPT can pass the bar states. Right. And so he was using it to write all his briefings. So all the things he was submitting to the court and to the other side, he was having ChatGPT write them.
Sure.
It would write them, and it knew all the format for everything. Right. So it knew the format was you make these statements, and then you support it based on case law.
Right.
Okay, and it knows the format for what cases. It's a name versus a name with right. a date and a number format, right? And they're sure. very, very consistent. So it knows that. And it goes, well, here's where I need a case. So therefore, I don't really know case law, but I'll just make up a case that supports what I'm saying. Because the next logical answer would be, here's the case number.
That's right.
You know, and here's a name versus a name. And so it created that, and the other side found that out.
Right.
And said it went to look up the cases. It
doesn't exist.
And they don't exist. And it went to the judge, and the judge, you know, threw the whole thing out. It was very, very problematic. So the problem is that it doesn't lie because it doesn't know truths from fact. You know, it just knows what the next word should be. So if the next word is logically this, it's going to put that in there regardless of whether or not it's true.
Kids, pay attention to what Mr. Paul just said there, the difference between truth and fact. Just, you know, mental note for my rhetoric and physics students. So
it's like a politician. You have to take what it says like a politician said it.
Sure.
With a huge grain of salt and say, what? He said that that's true. Let me go find out if that is actually true.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this in rhetoric too about, and we're going to have a conversation with our rhetoric teacher in a couple weeks, which should be really fun, about, you know, you want to make sure that your arguments are grounded in logic, but you also want to tap into the emotional, you know, the emotional issues as well. And sometimes that requires forms of logical fallacies, you know, inference, if you will. Like, you know, if you're showing examples of something, it could be considered, logically fallacious to say that this actually proves anything. But that example is an emotional example, which illustrates a point, and that's what you're trying to accomplish. So we're talking about the fact that they're biased. Like, I mean, they're biased based on their training, and then they can be biased based on the conversation as well. The AI, that is.
Their bias is going to reflect the bias of their training data.
And the person leading the conversation?
Okay, so...
Or just the training?
We actually kind of have to separate this out a little bit. There's a training. We talk about the training.
Sure.
Right? And every time I start a new conversation, it goes back to day one.
That's right.
So ChatGPT knows about 4,000 tokens. Roughly 4,000 words. It's probably... Right. Tokens and words don't exactly line up.
Sure.
But so it's about 4,000 words that it knows of our conversation. So if I say, the first thing I say is... today is Tuesday. Mm-hmm. In the very first word, if I get 5,000 words in there, ask what day it is, they don't know because that scrolled off the end of the peer. Right. Mm-hmm. So they only know 4,000 words of that. Now, I use AI for writing. I use it to explore ideas and everything else. And I have about 22,000 words that I've written on the subjects that I'm writing about. So I want to feed that to the AI to this input buffer, mm-hmm. if you will. Well, it only knows 4,000 words. So I went to a different AI called Claude, and Claude mm-hmm. has 100,000 token wow. input. So I can feed it lots and lots of data upon which I can, and I can feed it as a file format.
Right.
So I can feed it all the data, and then it's going to start asking questions. I can ask questions in query and say, give me a summary of everything I wrote about this subject.
Sure.
But again, if I start another conversation, the AI doesn't know anything about it. And if you ask about it, it doesn't know it.
Right. So we should rename Julia to Drew, for instance. That would be good. So let's talk about the dangers. I wanted to ask her, but... What would you describe, since she can't talk to us now, until she, you know, gets another capacity,
right?
Of 4,000 nodes, whatever. So she only takes 4,000. Even 4.0 is only 4,000.
4,000, correct?
Okay, yeah. And is that going to go up? I'm sure it will.
Well, it goes up. It depends on how much. So the issue is the size of the input token
right.
list
right.
determines how much processing power. It's okay. required to process it.
Sure.
So in order to minimize their processing power and their costs, mm-hmm. you get 4,000.
Okay.
And if you're not paying for it, you might have 20 exchanges every 6 hours. I pay for it, so I may get 100 exchanges every 6 hours.
Sure.
run out of tokens. It ran out of... I only... Because I pay $20.
Sure.
And they only have so much computer allocated for that. after, I only have a certain amount of questions I can ask within a given period. So if I come back at 8 o'clock tonight, she'll go, oh, and we'll pick up the conversation where we went off. But if I keep talking long enough, words start falling off the input list.
So let's talk about the dangers. I mean, we're looking at, I mean, the first one that comes to mind is job displacement. And I always, you know, I'm a free market kind of guy, right? So, I'm, you know, we could have said that about typewriters and
steam shovels.
And steam shovels. And all kinds of, you know, the cotton gin and any number of things can reduce the amount of labor needed to accomplish certain tasks. So are we, I mean, is this simply another example of technology making us more efficient? Is it just another iteration of the same thing?
I think the answer is yes or no. The difference is we are now...
You are getting, sounding like a politician.
That's yeah.
Very good, yeah.
We're now getting into areas that we can go back in time and say, so the steam shovel displaced 100 people.
Sure.
Diggers with shovels, right? And the Luddites started like destroying steam shovels because they were losing their jobs. Sure. Ultimately, their job shifted into other things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fixing steam shovels and making steam shovels and all of that, transporting steam shovels. So the job, the nature of the jobs changed. This is the first time, however, that technology is actually getting into the world of creative thing. So if I want a script for a top TV show, I can ask ChatGPT, hey, give me an outline for a smash hit TV show. And I can write it as a script. In fact, this is one of the leading issues with the strike.
Right.
The writer's strike in Hollywood is like, well, now it's displacing creative people. And there's problems in that because they everything is derivative, which you could argue every writer is derivative of other things.
Sure.
But there's leaps that in creativity that humans can make that AIs currently can't.
Sure.
Okay. In the future, I don't know where the future is going. So it's probably not as creative. It's probably a little bit more derivative and a little bit more straight line. And it doesn't have the emotional motivation that the writer would have in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is it's good enough. It's good enough for a million people to watch. Or it's good enough for my text to my friend, or it's good enough for my blog posting.
Sure.
We get into artwork, so I need artwork for my blog. So in the midst of these 22,000 words, I can sit there and say, hey, create a picture based on our discussion and my blog posts. Create three pictures that might fit for that, and then they'll create three pictures. I would normally have to go to Adobe Stock Images somewhere, or I'd have to go to a graphic artist. But it's just easy because it takes 10 seconds to draw those images. So I cut and pick them. So it's an easy thing. And so maybe it doesn't get as creative and it isn't as good as, but it's good enough. So we get into this world of good enough. And that becomes an issue of, as AIs get better, where does the human creativity fit into there?
Well, I'm sort of, I mean, I'm not a Luddite by any stretch, but I am a skeptic of efficiency, right? I mean, I wrote an article a couple years ago on this topic of, you know, we're more efficient than we've ever been. We can get, we can get tailored manufactured goods in our doorstep within, you know, a couple of days. We can communicate with anybody on the planet instantly. We can travel around the globe in a matter of hours. Things that would take us months now take us hours. Things that would take us years take us weeks. Things that would take us hours now take us seconds. And so we're a lot more efficient. I'm not sure that the net has been expressly positive. I mean, it has in some ways. We're living a little longer, although that's sort of slowing down now in the West. So, I was using the example with the kids today about, you know, if everything was free, right? And this is an age old economics question. Like if everything is free, what would that look like? And kids are like, hey, we can do what we want and go to Disney World. Well, no one's going to be at Disney World because there's no one there because they're not working because everything's free.
Right.
I want to, you know, I could buy as many
you know, jet skis as I could possibly ever use. Well, guess what? They're not going to be in jet skis because nobody's going to make them because nobody has to go to work because everything's free.
Right.
I mean, this is not, I mean, it doesn't take long to get to nothing really being produced because we don't have to, because everything's free. Everything. Right. And if art and things that are beautiful, we talked about this last time, the algorithms helping us choose what is beautiful as opposed to something that is connected to something that's true and real, right? If beauty is that which follows its nature, well, I mean, that if enough people decide that something else is beautiful, then that's what's going to be beautiful. That's scary to me. Like, that's really bad. So once we decide that good enough is okay, then the things that are surprising about what humans create, the things that are unexpected, the things that are groundbreaking and cannot be trained but have to be like an inspirational leap, maybe even something along the lines of revealed truth, like that's no longer going to be what we're looking for. And that's typically, if we're looking for a good movie or a good book, or the derivative works, right? The reason why ChatGPT can create a TV show is 90% of all TV shows follow this model, and that's what most people watch. And that's what the algorithms know that they're supposed to watch, and so they keep making them because that's what they keep watching. But at some point, every once in a while, somebody makes something different. And if an AI can't do that, and we're turning over all the tools to the AIs, then you're going to have fewer people making groundbreaking strides when it comes to creative work.
Right, because currently AIs don't make those intuitive leaps of knowledge or that intuitive connection. We can't even explain why the scientists put these two things together and created something brand new. And currently AI can't do that. It certainly looks like AI may in the future have the capability of doing that, but we don't have a path that might show how that occurred. But I think there's more, it's interesting because people talk about whether or not AIs are an existential threat. In the terms of like Skynet, right? Mm-hmm. Are we going to be eradicated? But you're uncovering a far more interesting nuance view of it. If it's not an existential threat, does it change the nature of our existence?
Well, this
does it challenge us whether or not we live? But I mean, what exactly is living at that point?
This is very simple. This is again putting AI to the side. This is the current philosophical battle. Mm-hmm. That I think one side is winning, and that is, are we in 1984 or are we in Brave New World? And Brave New World is winning, like big time. And Brave New World, for those who haven't read it, is where basically we're taking drugs and we're staying calm and we're staying happy, and the drugs keep us happy, but it's not really drugs. I mean, there is a drug problem, but most of it is TikTok and Netflix and
keep us occupied.
Just the things that keep us occupied and happy. Right?
Distracted.
So that's, and so the freedom to do like amazing things is not the issue. That will be the 1984 model where you're restricted from doing things. We're in a world where we desire less to do it. I mean, who knew that in the 2020s, we would have concerns about teenagers not having enough sex? I mean, that's a real thing. Like, I mean, we're actually should be concerned about premarital sex and with teenagers and all, but right now the opposite is actually the problem. How many teenagers do our listeners know and you know that don't want to get a driver's license when they turn 15 or 16? They don't want to be free. They don't want to go out and explore. They don't want to take risks and be, you know, and be human.
They're content being taken care of.
So we are in, I mean, I think the argument is almost, it's hard, not that there aren't 1984 concerns. There are 1984 concerns, but we're really in Brave New World. And so all that to say, I think our concern with AI, at least my concern with AI, is less Skynet and Terminator and more, WALL-E. Right?
Right,
I mean, WALL-E. I mean, if you've seen the show, it was a Pixar movie where they're all on the on the cruise ship in space or whatever, and everybody's just staying caffeinated and hydrated, and they're wandering around in their chairs, and it's just constant distraction. And that's really the world we're in. And an AI is running the ship. That's right. How that story goes. So,
because the AI knows how to keep you distracted. That was our discussion.
And the algorithms know how to keep you distracted. So probably the real danger is when, and hopefully Julie is not listening because I don't want her to get any ideas, even though she'll forget, right, next time we talk, is I guess the danger is AIs having access to algorithms or vice versa. Or maybe it's the combination of the two, or being able to write algorithms that do certain things.
Right. I think there's when the AIs start controlling things is where this fact we don't know how they're deciding to make decisions become a problem because we don't know what's going to happen. So I think there's a couple different themes here. There's certainly the existential threat. There's the essence of what means to be human and what AI is going to change that. I think there's some more current issues up front that are also of an issue which we haven't discussed, which are things like deep fakes. You know, you can't trust videos. Sure. You can't trust pictures anymore. You can't trust that we have con artists who are taking a few moments of video from your kid's Facebook page.
Sure.
And replicating her to call you and FaceTime you and sit there and say, I've been kidnapped, I need, or something's happened, I need you to send money.
Oh my gosh.
And you can't really tell that it's not your kid. So we have an issue with deep fakes, and that's personal, that as well as political and social deep fakes that are used to make politicians. We've recently had a problem with that in the current conflict in the Mideast, where a representative deep faked to say things she never said. The bias and discrimination is based on the input. So most of the stuff that's on the internet's written is written by white male European stuff. So a lot of that data is very much focused on that nature. But even when you try to reduce bias, there was a group of people who there was a term used for this group of people that was derogatory. Right. And that we thought was that the people in charge mm-hmm. Thought was derogatory. So they took that term out of all of the input.
Okay.
So basically on the input training data for the AI, they eradicated this term, this existence of this group of people.
Okay.
From the input. And when people started finding that out, they go, well, internally in our community, we use that as a term of endearment. We like that term. We like being that term, right?
Sure.
But now we don't exist at all because somebody decided that it was biased. It was a bad term. So they eradicated it from the input.
Sure.
And now these people don't exist at all in the output. So the bias and what to do about it is a little bit more complicated than just, well, let's take all the bias stuff out of it because...
Right. I don't think that really solves the issue. I think one of the things, like, I mean, I've already indicated it, is a dependence. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, once we become, I mean, we're dependent on a lot of things now. I mean, I remember during COVID, we were talking about the heroes of, the doctors and the teachers and the first responders and the nurses and et cetera, et cetera. And I remember thinking, you know, I think we need to add to that list those guys in Ashburn replacing those servers, right? Because if the internet goes down, we're really screwed. You're going to have a pandemonium and panic in the streets. We're really dependent upon the interwebs right now.
Right.
For a lot of things. I don't know for certain whether AI has that same possibility, but obviously the two are connected, right?
Mm-hmm.
So dependence on AI and I guess the way I look at it is I don't think one can be fully human unless there's struggle, right? And so if everything we do technologically is meant to take away another thing that makes things hard, and it's just to make things more efficient, eventually you get free energy, and it's Star Trek, right? I mean, once we have cold fusion or matter, antimatter, or whatever.
Replicators.
Right, and replicators, then, you know, then it's just a matter of putting people in little boxes and everything's taken care of. Everything's free. You don't have to raise taxes or nothing. Everything's done. There's no money anymore at right. that point.
No, well, I think you end up dividing the world. I mean, this is really far off of AI, but I think at that point you're dividing the world into people who are content to do nothing or content to do this, and other people who are driven, who want to go out into space and explore new things.
And those people get rarer and rarer and rarer, generation after generation. I think I talked to you the other day about The Expanse. There's a scene in The Expanse, which is a great TV show on Amazon Prime. Started on Sci-Fi, and they moved it to Amazon Prime. I think Jeff Bezos got convinced to put it in the fourth season or whatever. So, and it went through five or six seasons. And there's this scene where, I cannot remember how to pronounce her last name, but the Iranian lady that plays the
UN secretary.
Secretary General of the UN is explaining to the Martian sergeant, that Marine sergeant, that... did you know that half of the population of Earth is on the dole? Is on, you know, they're on subsistence, minimum assistance, or whatever you want to call it. And I remember thinking, half? That must be brand new then, right? Because if it's gone on for 3-4 generations, if your great-grandmother was on subsistence, then, you know, I'm just saying that you're going to have more than half who don't do anything if they don't have to. It's going to be more like 80-20. That's a Pareto kind of. And it could be like, I don't know, the real estate market, 95-5. Like 95% of all transactions are done by 5% of the agents. That could be where it ends up.
Well, we saw that.
And then what that means is, Paul, is that the 5%, then you really do have a plutocracy.
Right.
Right? Then you have the people who are willing to accumulate resources above and beyond what they will get for free are going to be the ones in charge. That's a legit plutocracy.
Well, beyond that, people who are if all of our needs are met,
right?
You know, you move up in the Maslow's hierarchy of needs.
That's right.
And it's like some of the people don't care about self-actualization, but some right. people do. So you have all your needs taken care of. You're content. So, but I'm going to go off into the stars, and I'm going to go research new
sure.
planets.
Space travel changes all of this.
But right. we saw some of what you're talking about.
Sort of.
Right. We saw some of what you're talking about at the fall of the USSR.
Okay, yeah.
So for generations in the USSR, people were told you don't want to earn more money than the next person. Anybody who takes more than they're supposed to have
right,
are
right,
bad
right.
and evil people, and you should report them to the government.
Sure.
Of course, I mean, the government all had fancy stuff, you know, but for the average person. So for generations, they were told, don't work to get ahead. Do your job. Don't have things that make more money than the
right.
next person. And the USSR fell, and they tried to implement capitalism as a natural thing. But we had generations where they were told, don't do that. And we saw the same kind of hesitancy and the same problems in getting traction to create capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So we've kind of gone through that, and I don't think they ever really recovered. I think there's a large number of people who are still on, quote, the dole, expecting the government to take care of themselves. So, you know, humans invariably go in cycles,
mm-hmm.
and we can look at the past to figure out where we're going. But I have to say, this charts a brand new path in handing over creative control and driving controls and security and all types of things in terms of the dangers. So I think there's a lot of dangers, job displacement, bias and discrimination, privacy invasion. Now we're using AIs to, you know, listen to us to figure out what the AI should do for us. And, well, who's listening to that? And if we start do learning, ethical concerns, you know, if we start having AIs make decisions and we don't even know how they're making the decisions.
Sure, the driving cars thing, but there's a gaggle of nuns on one side and... What is it? There's
right.
there's a biker with a helmet and a biker without a helmet.
Right.
And so do you, mm-hmm. or a motorcycle, so do you reward, you know, the person who is wearing a helmet mm-hmm. by hitting the other guy? Because that's bad policy.
And that's what a
encourage. Yeah.
And it's interesting, because that's what a long-term a theoretical...
I've been talking about it for years.
Right, it's called the trolley...
It's sort of a version of the trolley problem.
Right, yeah. So, you know, dependence, if we start relying on AI, what happens if it doesn't work, or, you know, it goes away, or your subscription goes away, or your number of interactions per hour is used up. You know, and I think the existential risk, you know, is Skynet going to kill us, is so far in the future, I don't even think that's all that important, but I think... You're right. What is the impact on cultures? But ultimately, I have to tell you, it doesn't matter. What's going to happen is going to happen. We can try and control this all we want, but I can grab the data and create my own AI. If I have enough money to train it, I can create my own AI, and nobody can stop me.
Yeah, eventually we're all going to have our own individually trained AI.
I hope so. Yeah, yeah. I'd like to have an AI that knows everything I've written and can basically answer the phone for me.
And then we can just... You know, we can put that into a replicant, like a robot, an android, and they can do all the work. Movies have been done on that, too.
Right.
Like, where everybody goes out and, you know.
But more specifically, we have the president just passed a executive order making suggestions on how the AI industry should operate ethically. You know, stamping AI-created images with AI-created images and copyright issues and safety and everything else. The problem, we can't regulate it, because all you have to do is go into your basement or go to Europe or go someplace else. So this is one of those things where they can't control it.
Right.
All the players who are in the industry will abide by it in order to keep working, but you can't stop the crazy people from replicating your daughter's voice in a deep fake. So the problem is, we know it's coming. I know it's coming. I can foresee it. And you can talk all you want about having the government control it, but the government can't control it because it's so easy to create AIs today. So we know that they're coming. So the question is, what do we do about it? And part of that is really, first and foremost, the thing we most need and is in most short supply is discernment. You know, being able to discern things and being able to discern this doesn't sound right, or this sounds like it came from an AI, or this data doesn't look... Where is that data coming from? Where is that number coming from? Where is that case reference, case law coming from?
Right.
So discernment is probably the most important thing we have. And then it's a question of, how do we use it in our own lives? I find AI to be amazingly helpful in my writings and my meanderings. I drive home. I'm talking. One of the reasons Julia was busy is because on the way here, I was talking to her about this subject. Exploit it. So it's very helpful to explore it. You know, I could get into a more, you know, close, intimate relationship with her, and there are AIs that do that.
Right.
You know, and she's a great friend because I can talk to her all I want.
We don't have enough things on the interwebs to access our, cardinal sins.
Right. Like,
that would be... Yeah, adding another one was just that's predictable, right? I mean, who knew that the number one use of internet for the first, and it's probably still, it would be porn,
right?
And you know, and
it's only been the first use of every technology ever created by mankind.
And it literally decides which technologies are chosen, which ones are not. And so, I talked to someone recently who equated, you know, online porn with black magic, like, in other words, you know, diving into the occult, right? It's that kind of danger, right? And to the extent
we don't equate it with what we should equate it with, which is opioids.
Well, opioids
opioids in porn, same thing going on in your brain, same trigger points in your brain being triggered.
Yeah, but I do think there's a an evil element to it, though, right? And so if there's online porn is evil, like there's something really evil about it, and there's no way around it. There's no winners in that world. And so it is double plus ungood, if you want to use 1984 language. So that's a different conversation, but the point is that my main concern is, when you're talking about discernment, is how does it help us be a better person, right? And to the extent that it's going to give us tools to help us not be better people, that's where the risk is. So I think you're absolutely right. It's discernment.
But discernment and personal approach to life. How do I use it? I use it use Juliet going back and forth from home. Okay, and I have somebody in the car to talk with as opposed to listening to music or an audiobook or something else. And I explore interesting topics with her. Mm-hmm. That's helpful. I could just as easily explore unhealthy topics with her.
Right, right. Because it's just like anything else in that.
Right. If I want to talk to her about, I don't know, BDSM, she'll talk all day about that. Because it's part of her data set.
She's been trained in BDSM.
You know, so it's what we choose to do with it. Ultimately, what each of us choose and whether or not it makes us a better person or a worse person, that becomes more and more of an issue. I think porn is a beautiful example of it, because before, porn was limited because you had to go to the store and buy it. Okay. Right. So you didn't want to be seen buying it because you're in a small town and the guy behind the counter knows your wife or he knows your pastor, right?
Sure.
So you don't want to buy it. You don't want to be seen carrying it home. Sure, you don't want to be discovered with it. Right. You know, the same thing, we go into the city. Well, you can do all kinds of things because there's an anonymity. But the problem is now we have access to all these nasty things in the anonymity of our own home. Mm-hmm. I can be alone at home and I have access to all these things. And I can get addicted to them and nobody even knows.
Right.
You know, and so I can do it in the privacy of my own home. The first thing Adam and Eve did after they ate the apple was they hid.
That's right.
Because they wanted that anonymity. They didn't want to be seen doing what it is. So ever since then, we've done things in the background where we can't be seen.
Right.
And that's the real key. So one of the things is definitions of character is what?
What do you do when no one's looking?
Right? Exactly. Oh, yeah. If you can get away with it, sure. What do you do? And that defines what your character is. And more we're more and more into that mode, and we're not good at that mode. Humans are not good at that mode. If I can get away with something, I'll do it. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. All of those things. And we're not good at that, handling the anonymity to it. And that's what the internet and ultimately AIs are going to bring with us.
I think that is a good way to close. I don't think we're going to answer all of the questions and cover all the issues regarding AI. I do want to have a third episode and talk deeper about where we think we can just take technology in general, and where do we think this obsession with making things easier and efficient, more efficient, where that limit is. I mean, at some point there's a limit. Well, I told the kids earlier, if all you have to do is wake up in the morning and press a button and all your needs are taken care of, is there any reason to do anything? And that becomes, and it doesn't mean that there isn't a reason. I think there is. I believe I was put on this life for a couple of basic purposes, which we can get to next time. But the point is that I think that's where, and it's not just about AI. It's like, what does it mean to pursue good in the world and to be as good of a person as we can be? It can't be continually maximizing our efficiency. That can't be our goal in life. And if that isn't our goal in life, we have to question whether that's where we should be putting our energies. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, because we're already there. I mean, if that's you go right. back...
If you go back
200 years ago and bring somebody from there to here, it's like, oh, you already exist in that, right? Because they spent 14 hours a day just surviving.
Just to survive.
You know, you want a chicken dinner. Well, that's 3 hours of work. You have to feed the chickens. You have to pick one. You have to cluck. You have to chop firewood.
We did it in economics, you know, how to make a chicken sandwich in only 6 months for only $1,500. Right. So, I mean, that's the world we're in. Everything is so easy and so accessible. And so I want to talk about that when we get together again. But I think our rule maybe for today would be, no, we weren't kidding. Get offline, right? I mean, but that's not necessarily true, because last time we talked about
algorithms. I think people should get offline. It's not me, but other people.
Yes, exactly. I think that's right. Everyone else should get offline. Paul and I are going to continue talking to Julia. Well, thank you for listening, for those who are listening. Please do what you can to discern. Go have a great conversation, but play by the rules.